This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. My name's Jacob.
Well, I must be Mercedes then. And we're on Community Radio 3CR with Friday Rave.
And that's right. Welcome back to a Friday Rave on Community Radio 3CR. You're at 855 on your AM dial or at all the W's at 3cr.org.au or, of course, by 3CR Digital or by your whiz-bang flash military surveillance chopper in the sky. And we're back on air after having a little break last week after coming back from the convergence. And Jake is with us on the airwaves. Hey, Jake.
Yeah, g'day. I'm up on the north coast of New South Wales where I haven't seen a helicopter for days.
Oh, that must be lovely. The Preston ceiling fan doesn't make it that far up there.
Yeah, exactly.
And how's things on the road?
Oh, yeah, look, things are on the road. Doesn't stop, mate. It's just the head stays in the same place. It's just the body that lives.
Yeah, for sure. And well, I mean, I don't know if my head stays in the same place this week. I feel like my head's just been absolutely all over the place trying to prepare for this week's show. We've had a couple of had a few chats this week about what the hell we're going to talk about and how we're going to do it and where to start and far out. It's I think what did we say yesterday? Just when you think it can't get any more effed, it does.
It does. It just gets darker and darker. Sometimes, if you want to keep your sanity, don't read history.
Far out. Or if you want to understand the present, do. I don't know. It's yeah. What are we? Yeah. What are we going to? We have been talking about.
Well,
yeah. Go ahead. You go.
I was going to say next week is Hiroshima and Nagasaki days. We're on the 8th, which is in the middle of the two. So next week we want to have a. Yeah, we're going to have a yarn, I think, about the companies involved that built the bomb.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the connections between, Hiroshima Day and how this fostered the rise of the modern military-industrial complex.
Yeah, and was called it at that time, I think. Is that right? Is it Eisenhower who kind of said that this was the development of what the military-industrial complex will be?
That's right, yeah, and that's right, and Eisenhower. Now, I've spoken on the Friday Rave about Eisenhower before, and particularly the way he spoke out against the undue influence of the military-industrial complex. But Eisenhower also has a dark side, which I might get to, depending on how we're going for time in today's rave.
All right, well, I mean, I want to say I look forward to hearing that, but it sounds kind of damning. But I think, as you said, we need to know it.
Yeah, look, going to talk about the Congo because Donald Trump this week has announced he'll be hosting the leaders of Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. Felix Tshisekedi and Paul Kagame, respectively, at the White House to broker a peace deal, which will be based around granting US access to critical minerals. In the DRC.
Mm-hmm.
But and I've got to say, when I'm talking about, I don't want to keep saying the DRC and don't want to keep saying the Democratic Republic of Congo. So if I just mention the Congo, just be aware I'm talking about the DRC, not the RC.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to have a look, not just at the current state where more than 100 different armed insurgent groups are operating, but at the history of how it got to be there. And Mercedes, we were talking before the show, we were wondering where to start. You know, most of the analysis about what's happened in the Congo starts with the after effects of the Rwandan genocide in the 90s or the Congo, first civil war, then second civil war in the 70s and then 90s.
Mm.
But I think go further than that, back a century and a half to the Berlin Conference and the carve-up of Africa in the 1880s.
Yep.
And, yeah. And we could go further to the Industrial Revolution and the movement of people into the cities and the technological innovations which came together with surplus value generated by the Industrial Revolution. But how far do you want to go?
How far? Well, I think the Berlin Conference in 1884, which, you know, has been we've spoken about on the show before, and indeed you have, but I guess together we've mentioned it. But, you know, what that actually meant, and the free trade deals in and out of the Congo Basin, emerging from the Congo Basin as a place for European powers to exploit the mineral-rich areas and go through to have free trade access through the Congo Basin as part of that, the Berlin Conference of what came from that. And I think, I mean, one of the little rabbit holes that I went down that I just want to mention was that just before the Berlin Conference, which is in November 1884, in October was the International Meridian Conference, which kind of formalised Greenwich Mean Time, which internationalised and formalised naval and trading shipping routes internationally, which I think just the timing of that is interesting.
Of course, it was all about trade.
Mm.
Well, exploitation, resource depletion. It's all about trade, you know. And one of the big ones, and where we'll, I mean, I've spoken about the Berlin Conference on a Friday rave before, was in relation to the Sahel and the coups that were happening there. But another big part of it was about King Leopold getting control of the Congo as a personal fiefdom. And at the time, the Congo was the Kingdom of Congo. It was a nation, and it was recognised as a nation. Portugal had a big interest in it. It had been busy there for years, dividing the people by converting some to Catholicism and enslaving the others for their sugar plantations in St. Thome and the Americas. But now Leopold claimed it was a personal fiefdom, and he went on to oversee what has become known as the first modern genocide. There's that word again. We'll hear that a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Where up to 20 million Congolese were massacred for the sake of rubber and ivory. So, and you know, I just like to put things in a cultural context, as you know, all the time. And when you talk about the late 19th century and, you know, you think of ivory, you think of, I can't help but think of all the people sitting in theatres and opera houses all around the world listening to people playing piano.
Mm.
And all the ivory from all those keys came from the Congo.
Yeah. And they all came from the Congo. And then also, you know, what's his name? Stanley. Henry Morton Stanley at the time, you know, as this offsider of Leopold, which Leopoldville, Kinshasa, was formerly known as Leopoldville under the rule of Leopold. Is that right?
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
And setting up, and Henry Morton Stanley as an offsider being sent to set up a long road, which the American Colonization Society, who were operating out of Liberia at the time, were reporting back to the US on the development of those trade centres, what would become larger trade centres in the Congo Basin.
Exactly. And it's interesting you mentioned Stanley, because at the Berlin Conference, the US was represented. The US had three reps there, and one of those reps was Henry Morton Stanley. So while he was actually working for King Leopold, he was also representing the United States at the Berlin Conference.
Mm. Playing both sides.
So, you know, and just to put it in perspective, that was the beginning. That, you know, that it was the Berlin Conference because Germany called the conference, and Germany had only just it was the beginning of the nation state of Germany. They'd only just amalgamated as a nation 20 or so years before. And they were building an army and a navy in the Baltic, which created the arms buildup that led to World War One. And some analysis I've read of the Berlin Conference suggests that a secondary purpose of it was to deny arms to the African nations by placing them under European control.
Mm.
So it's, you know, it gets weirder and weirder. But, you know, King Leopold, to get the rubber and the ivory, in an eerie harbinger, I think you could say, of the Ukraine's Brave One program, that we talked about a couple of months ago, that where soldiers get points for kills, African mercenaries were made to account for the bullets they used by collecting the hands of the dead to get more shells. And so, therefore, the African mercenaries, which were set against each other by Portugal, the African mercenaries were then cutting people's hands off while they still lived and not using the shells in order to stockpile shells for their own purposes.
Yeah, right.
It just gets so dark. And then another factor of it, of course, is that the Congolese women, we hear about the miners and we hear about the kids and we hear about the blokes working the mines, but Congolese women were a whole caste of sex slaves used by African mercenaries and by the Europeans that they still haven't recovered from. Mm. And, you know, we're talking 100 years ago and, you know, there are still the ramifications of the mixed, you know, the European kids and the mixed kids who are still suffering torment over what happened to their grandmothers and great-grandmothers 100 years ago.
And the intergenerational trauma.
And no one meant intergenerational trauma. And people just, even the good left historical analyses of the Belgian Congo and the Free Congo State under Leopold don't mention very often, the effect it had on the women of the Congo. It was crazy.
As often happens, really.
But anyway, as often happens, but this was far and away one of the more egregious examples of it, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But anyway, by about 1908, I think it was, 1908, the Belgian government had enough of Leopold's excesses and they took over and they were marginally better, not quite as heinous. But in the meantime, and this is where I want to get on to because we're talking about Hiroshima Day next week, uranium was discovered at Katanga in the southeast of the country. Yeah. After Germany, that was in 1920-something, and... No, it was 1916, but started being developed in 1920. And then when the Second World War was on, Germany occupied Belgium and they took control of the uranium that was sitting on the Belgian docks to advance their nuclear program. But the head of the mining company sent stockpiles of the ore to New York and then later stored it in a warehouse on Staten Island. And then from 1941, I think it was, about 400 tons of the ore each month were shipped from the Congo to New York, which is where the uranium for Little Boy and Fat Man actually came from.
Wow, 400 tons of the ore that was extracted. Wow.
A month. And that's what a big part, it's not talked about because it was all secret, but
oh,
that's
course.
What a big part of the American-German sea battles in the Atlantic were about protecting the uranium cargo going to the United States. And then, later on, Congo was one of the first countries in Africa to achieve independence in the decolonization process, but it wasn't left in peace. You know, 100 years of first Portuguese, then Belgian troublemaking made sure that the different powers supported different tribal groupings and against the leader of the newly independent state, Patrice Lumumba, who listeners may have heard of. And he was eventually overthrown and executed with the support of the US.
Yeah.
And the bloke who was taken... Sorry?
Oh, I was just going to say I think it was around the time of 1960 and 1961 and Patrice Lumumba's assassination... And there was I was just actually just reading about Israel's role in playing both sides of, you know, following the US support to back and provide military training and assistance, Israeli military training and assistance to Mobutu's army. That was in 1960.
Mobutu.
Oh, I think
I've lost you. Are you there?
Oh, hello, can you hear me? We're on.
Hello, got you. Sorry, folks.
Sorry about that, folks.
Yep. Mobutu. That's all right. Mobutu was took over from Lumumba, but Lumumba was executed, and it was reported that from the person who was taken minutes with a meeting and with Eisenhower, that Eisenhower suggested Lumumba's execution. And it's supposed to be the first time, who knows, a US president ordered the execution of a foreign leader.
Wow.
Certainly wasn't the last.
Wasn't the last, no.
But anyway, regardless of all things, the important things in life, the uranium, the copper, the critical minerals, diamonds for a short time, continued to be mined, you know. And Japan mining, strangely enough, just a small aside, in the 1970s, Japan mining was involved in Katanga, extracting mainly copper but also uranium. And when they left, they undertook what has become known as the Katangan infanticide. I don't want to go into it, but look it up, the Katangan infanticide. But anyway, France
That's continued as well. A memorandum of understanding has just been signed between the DRC and Japan for financial assistance for manganese and copper and cobalt mining. And that's only just been in the last few months.
That's right, yeah. And cobalt, I'll get into the cobalt in a minute. But, you know, in the meantime, France stopped supplying Israel with uranium because of the 1967 wars. And it appears that the Belgian company, the same one that provided the US with the uranium for the Manhattan Project, Union Minière, did a deal with Mossad to send 200 tons of Congolese uranium to Israel, and that's what started the Israeli nuclear weapons project in Dimona.
Wow.
So, you know, it just is all tied in, and we've spoken about rubber, ivory, you know, there's copper or two that was going to Japan and uranium. But you can't really talk about Congolese resources without talking about diamonds. You know?
Yeah.
Diamonds that discovered in Congo about 1912. And that's how Belgium became one of the big players in the international diamond industry. There are three main diamond exchanges in the world. One's in Belgium, and the other two are in Israel and India. Mm. And India, of course, has been mining diamonds since antiquity, and it's natural they're a player. Belgium got into the game because of the early exploitation of the Congo. But Israel's diamond industry, okay, strap yourselves in. It began before the state itself. European Jews had played a big role in Europe's diamond industry since the 16th century. And a part of that was because it was one of the few, diamond and gold was one of the few industries not controlled by guilds that they were able to get into. They were banned from so many other crafts and so many other businesses.
Mm.
But in 1932, a group of Belgian Jews working in the Belgian diamond polishing factories, and they immigrated to the British Mandate of Palestine and cut a deal with Britain to waive levies on imported rough diamonds. And then shortly after that, 5 years later, De Beers, who had a virtual monopoly of the diamond industry, they set up shop in Palestine too. And De Beers, for those who don't know, it's, you know, as I say, they had a virtual monopoly on the diamond industry. They were founded by Cecil Rhodes of Rhodesia in Bimini, and financed by the Rothschilds family. In 1929, when most of the West was suffering from the Great Depression, De Beers was bought by the Oppenheimer family through their connection. You know, their connection with Rothschilds continued So, I mean, here we have these
Oppenheimer family.
I didn't look to see if it was any relation, but it's not that common a name, I guess. When Germany, more about Oppenheimer next week, folks.
Yeah. And then
during the Second World War, Germany took control of Belgium in 1940, and the European diamond business went quiet. And so De Beers expanded into Palestine and kept their profits from diamonds growing. At the end of World War II, just looking at the figures here, the diamond industry employed 4,000 people and exported about $16 million. That's $16,000,000 worth of polished diamonds. And much of the profit from the De Beers diamond industry in Palestine went on to fund the Zionist colonialist project. You know, and then after the Nakba, De Beers began exporting rough diamonds to Israel in bulk for cutting and polishing. And this is what has developed to today being the largest diamond exchange in the world.
Yeah. And
they didn't stop.
No, go ahead.
Oh, you were telling me earlier about Dan Gertler.
Dan Gertler is an Israeli billionaire who currently has sanctions placed on him by the US for corruption in the Congo, who entered into the Congo in about 1997. But at the time, around just a few years after that, has been in, like, has... there was a current lawsuit, I'm not sure where it's going, that alleged that Dan Gertler was involved in a diamonds for arms deal, in trying to do these handshake deals to get rights to a diamond mining leases and extraction in exchange for Israeli military support for the Congolese army. But, you know, of course, nothing on paper. It was all these were all done by handshake deals. And so there was a lawsuit that was brought about in about 2004. And Dan Gertler also, you know, having to pay, he had a big diamond mine. The name of it evades me at the moment, but it's Dan Gertler International. And then there's a, you know, it's a conglomerate of companies.
DGI
that operate. But working alongside Sibat to provide military and material and arms support to the Congolese into the Congo in exchange for mining leases. So the corruption is there, but also I think, you know, of how in 1997, coming in at the time, I think, of where diamonds were getting traded across the border into Sierra Leone, and in exchange for arms within that border, and how to, I was just reading about yesterday the companies that were involved in kind of washing that illegal extraction and trade clean for further export.
Right. Oh, mate, and it's all about guns, you know, diamonds, guns, and money. I think was the name of the book, wasn't it?
Something like that.
But, look, Israel has a history of military sales and supports to all the lakes region of Africa, you know, Uganda, Burundi, Rwanda. And it's all secret. You know, the Israeli Supreme Court has ruled, just as an example, that all records of arms sales to Rwanda at the time of the Rwandan genocide have to remain secret so as not to expose Israel to bad press internationally. It's crazy. When, you know, they do publish information on large military sales, but their small arms exports are difficult to trace. And a recent report on the M23 insurgency earlier in the year suggests that M23 were using what appear to be Israeli-made weapons.
Ah.
And then, you know, last month, a high-level delegation from Israel and the US visited the DRC to arrange a release of three US citizens, one of them a joint US-Israeli citizen, being held on death row for the crime of plotting yet another coup. Now, they weren't released, but they had their death sentence commuted to life. And so, I mean, we're run out of time just about. It's 24 minutes past five.
But also, I think there was one point that we got back to in 2019 about another attempted coup that I didn't mention.
That's right. The former chief of Mossad was deported from Yossi someone.
Yossi Cohen was deported can you hear me?
Yep, got you now.
Yeah, Yossi Cohen was deported from the DRC in 2019, accused of plotting a coup to benefit business associates in the Congo.
Yeah. But just to bring it up to date, because we are running out of time, this is the environment that the US is talking about doing a deal to provide security to the region in exchange for mineral rights. You know, the DRC has the four largest cobalt deposits in the world, along with extensive deposits of lithium, copper, uranium, and tantalum. Currently, China's the DRC's biggest investor and customer. And this deal is not about peace and stability, but it's about the US's need to catch up with China in the critical minerals market. And Australia plays a role in that because the Australian company AVZ had negotiated the rights to the lithium, I think it was, in Manono mine. And then they got they had some grief from investors, and then the DRC cancelled their contract because they weren't fulfilling it and gave the contract to China. And AVZ sued the DRC and ended up with, I think it was about $70 million in compensation for their lost rights. And it's this, up until then, the US was counting on getting their lithium through an Australian, i.e. Western, i.e. controlled by American finance, and direct to the Pentagon. But when AVZ lost their deal and it went to China, it was like, well, bugger me, we need to get this back. And this is what has led to this peace deal.
Mm.
Okay, and then I also want to mentioned that the DRC is big on the US agenda. Earlier this year, Trump's new Africa advisor, and by the way, his daughter Tiffany's father-in-law, a bloke by the name of Massad Boulos, kicked off his official duties with a visit to the Congolese president, Felix Tshisekedi, in Kinshasa. And for those of you who do keep an ear on such things, the Pentagon's AFRICOM have been meeting this week with the Angolan Secretary of State and the top Angolan military brass about security issues. And top of the agenda was the security of the Lobito Corridor. That's the overland rail route from Luanda to the Atlantic coast through Angola and Zambia into the critical mineral and diamond-rich Katanga province. This has been partly developed already by China as part of its One Road project, so there's going to be some shenanigans going on over access to that.
Yeah,
and the DRC's got its own corridor, but that's a bit problematic with mountains and jungles. So I don't know where to go from that. Oh yeah, I've got to mention Jeff Bezos, and what's his name? The Microsoft bloke, Bill Gates.
Bill Gates and BHP cops a mention as well.
Yeah,
we do have about less than a minute left. Just letting you know, Jake.
Oh. All right, fair enough. Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, two of the richest men in the world, have secured the exploration rights in the DRC to find hitherto unknown deposits of critical minerals using a whole new computer algorithm, AI algorithm. But anyway, that's more than we've got. We've run out of time. I could keep on talking about this. And the last thing I want to say is that Congo also supplied the uranium for the British tests at places like the Montebello Islands just north of Australia and Maralinga. So it's not too far from home.
Not too far from home at all. We'll catch you next week with a little bit more information about how the company is involved in making the bomb. Until next week, the good folks at Slacker Radio are here. We'll talk to you soon.